Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 363 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 16th of February, 2018, as I record this. So today I'm talking to Rachel Herron about how to fast draft your memoir. And it's always a pleasure to talk to Rachel. She's just lovely. And I know many of you are writing memoir or want to, and it's definitely something I continue to flirt with. We talk a bit about that. Although, of course, I do include my journal entries in my nonfiction. So I guess I'm kind of sharing my memoir stuff as I go. So we talk about the nature of truth, treating yourself as a character, and the fears we tackle when we write our own stories. So great show coming up. So in futurist stuff, last week I talked about Amazon Polly, and Polly turns text to speech, and there was a new plugin that turns your turns your blog posts into like a podcast. And Polly has 47 different voices. It is Amazon technology, and as the rise and rise of AI stuff grows, it's really interesting to see where this might go. And coincidentally, and I didn't even know about this last week, but Jim Cookroll from the Sell More Book Show podcast, which is fantastic, has now launched book2pod.com. So book2pod.com, and you can upload your book and have it turned into a podcast, and it's basically read by Amazon Polly voices, and they have 47 voices, but Jim has picked the best four, so you can pick the voice you want to read. You can test drive it by uploading a short clip. So I wanted to let you hear what it sounds like, because I think it's really important to understand how fast this technology is moving. So coming up next is the little clip, and then I'll be back.
Successful Self-Publishing by Joanna Penn. It's important up front to focus on attitude. Many authors feel that marketing and sales are negative in some way, and that just makes the whole thing more difficult. But whether you have a traditional book deal or you are self-publishing, you will have to learn marketing if you want to make a decent level of sales. So it's time to reframe what marketing is. Marketing can be defined as sharing what you love with people who will appreciate hearing about it.
So I hope you enjoyed that little clip. And actually, it's better than I expected. I mean, it's clearly not a professional actor reading it, but it is heading in the right direction in that there is some intonation, some feeling, even if it's read by a machine. And I do think this will be the future of audio content, in that if you just consider the vast amount of written material on the internet, in books, just in general, I do think that we will be using this kind of technology over time. And I think it will go much, much further than we think. I fully expect the sort of voice to text and text to voice to be part of the way we interact with the world. And my husband has a friend who's blind, and he listens to emails and things at an incredibly fast rate, and then he will type out his replies, and it's so interesting, or speak his replies as well, and it's so interesting how the human brain adapts to this type of thing. So I definitely think this is fascinating, and given that audio is the fastest growing segment of publishing, and Amazon has Audible, it has Polly, it has all kinds of other technology, I think this is a content play for a future time, not that far away, when we will just, audio will be a huge part of our world. Of course, there will always be room for professional voice talent and the artisanal approach. So I don't think that will go away, in the same way that I don't ever think our jobs will be taken by the bots or the robots. I do think we will use them as tools. And I think this is another tool. So you can check out Jim's book2pod at book2pod.com, and the number two in the middle there.
Okay, so my personal update. The Dark Queen short story came out this week as a standalone short story for JF Penn. It was in the Feel the Fear anthology last year and is now available as a standalone on all the usual ebook platforms. I'll just read you the blurb. A sunken city, a lost goddess, and the woman who longs to find her. Lara is part of a dive team exploring the sunken city of Thonis Heraklion off the north coast of Egypt. When a storm threatens the site, there's only time for one last dive, and Lara is determined to be on it, even if it means diving with the man who threatened her this summer. Because the Dark Queen is down there, and Lara intends to find her before it's too late. So the story is based on the Sunken Egypt exhibition at the British Museum. And I love the British Museum. And in fact, I've written several books off exhibitions there. Religious Relics featured in Crypt of Bone. And also Day of the Vikings is actually written. The setting for Day of the Vikings is the British Museum when Neo-Vikings invade. So such a great place. If you haven't been and you visit London, definitely go. Also this week, The Healthy Writer is available in audiobook. Woohoo! I'm very excited. And it is a little different in that because Ewan and I co-wrote it and we wrote different chapters, we actually have two different voices reading the chapters. So my usual narrator, Caroline, is reading my chapters. And the male voice is the lovely Joe Penn. No relation. And Joe has a lovely voice and I really enjoyed QAing the audiobook. So available now on Audible, iTunes and the usual places. And of course, if you have your Audible credit, now might be a good time to use it. And of course, if you do enjoy it, a review would be much appreciated as ever. I am a little nervous about the two voices, so I'd love to get some reviews if you enjoy the book. Also, I am still working on how to write a non-fiction book, which will also be a course because I have a lot of questions about it. So please do email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com, with any thoughts on what you want to know about how to write a non-fiction book. It's interesting how different the questions are around non-fiction than it is for fiction. So this is something that people have been asking me about for years, so I'm knuckling down and finally writing it. I also have a draft of how to write a novel as a book, but goodness me, that's a difficult one to write. So I'm basically driving hard towards my 10-year mark in December 2018 when the Creative Pen will be 10 years old. And I want to, by then, I've talked about these pathways. And what I realised is that I have quite a lot of pathways for the later journey, as in or how to self-publish, how to market a book, and how to make a living with your writing, but I don't have much on the craft. So it's probably because I've been less confident about that, but now I've written 28 books, I do feel like I can share what I've learned. So I'm really coming around to sort of making these pathways by December. I'm also doing a lot of videos on YouTube. This week I released a tutorial on how to use Vellum to format your book. So you can check that out on youtube.com/thecreativepen. So yes, I'm busy, but I'm having fun and I really feel like I understand my direction at this point. I'm like, okay, back on course. Right. Okay. Useful stuff. Final reminder for the ConvertKit webinar this week. Lots of you really enjoyed the interview with Nathan Barry. So I will be doing a webinar with ConvertKit this week, a demo on how to use, why email is so important and also how to set up ConvertKit for your email list. That is Tuesday, 20th of February at 2 p.m. US Eastern, 7 p.m. UK, or register to get the recording, thecreativepen.com/CK webinar. And hopefully I will just redirect that link as well to the recording of the webinar if you can't make it live. So thecreativepen.com/CK webinar. So thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. It's been really great to get your feedback about the metaphor of the boat for your author career. I talked about my patchwork boat and as I said, I do feel like I'm back on course. My sails are filled with wind. Well, maybe the metaphor. metaphor can really be stretched, of course. But just to read a few comments, Imogen says, delighted by your personal news section. So refreshing to have someone point out that there are different ways to steer the ship. I was beginning to feel that I might not belong, and I'm so glad you've made me feel like I do again. It was great to hear from Imogen like that. And so often we feel like this self-doubt that buffets us, and we just think, oh my goodness, I'm going in the wrong direction. I don't fit into this type of world. But, you know, I'm really happy that we all now can feel that we all have our place and we all have our little boats. Kim said, loved your metaphor. I was worried for a minute, though, as you described the big cruiser and streamlined yacht. I thought your boat was going to end up something like a dugout canoe. Glad you made it quirky but ocean worthy. That is all about freedom. Freedom and independence have been my key themes, too. So true. We need to look carefully at what people are doing and not just at their results. So fantastic. Thanks, Kim. Ali says, at the moment, I think I'm in a wee rowing boat, having to expend a lot of energy to move and trying to find time to make the sail so the wind can help me along. That's a great metaphor. I like that a lot. I hope to upgrade to a larger boat at some point, capable of venturing out onto the sea. I'm a bit of an adventurer at heart. I suspect I may be distracted by the interesting looking islands. Fantastic. Julie Cordner says, I feel like I'm still collecting the wood to build my boat and looking around the marina, trying to decide what model to go for. This metaphor could run and run. I actually think the metaphor approach was the best way to go, because it really helps you consider the type of life you want as well as the type of boat you want. So we are going to continue with this metaphor. Edwin Downward says, had trouble not imagining my ship to be a leaky rowboat equipped with cracked oars held together by fishing wire. But it's the start. And then finally, the winner of this week's most original tweet is Savannah J. Goines says, listening to the show while cleaning my foster alligator's cage. He's staying with me for a few weeks after being found abandoned in an apartment until an alligator reserve can take him. I just love that. I was like, okay, foster alligator, why not? So please tweet me at The Creative Pen or leave a comment on the show notes. Or you can email me, Joanna, at The Creative Pen, with your thoughts about the show. And I really love to hear from you. It just makes this feel more like a conversation and helps me keep going. So thank you for all of that. So today's show is sponsored by my own How to Write a Novel course, where I guide you from idea to finished book so that you can finally write the novel you've been thinking about for years. One of my students, Holly, said, in 6 months, this course has taken my writing further than 6 years of self-teaching. Joanna's positive attitude and teaching style make learning how to write a novel enjoyable and feasible. And Lauren says, the course gave me the knowledge and motivation to finally turn my novel idea into an actual completed book. So in the course, I go through story structure, genre, aspects of a novel, as well as ideas, research, how to actually get words on the page, as well as editing and mindset. And the course includes video and audio lessons, as well as a workbook and a Facebook community where you can ask me questions and also hang out with the other students. So check that out at thecreativepen.com/write-novel. And as I mentioned, at some point soon, there will be how to write nonfiction as a separate course. So very excited there. So thanks also to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Eva Klingberg, Anne Catherine Bowman, Jay Sennett, 79 Franklin Press, Holger Niels Pohl, Emily Selleck, Kirsty Davis, Davilliers Keat, and Joyce Sosoben Roer. Thank you so much, all the new patrons, and of course, everyone who has been a patron for years now and months, and you are all wonderful. And I really appreciate that support on Patreon. And I just recorded and sent out the February extra Q&A. So if you can't get enough of my voice, then go support the show on Patreon and you'll get the extra Q&A. There are several years worth of backlist that you get access to. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get into the interview. Today, I'm here with Rachel Herron. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Hi, Joanna. So glad to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Rachel is the best-selling author of literary fiction, romantic comedy, and memoir. She teaches writing at UC Berkeley and Stanford. She's a podcaster, and her latest book is Fast Draft Your Memoir, Write Your Life Story in 45 Hours, which is amazing. And I just want to start, Rachel, have I pronounced Berkeley and draft in the right way?
Well, no, it would be Berkeley.
Ah.
You see Berkeley. That's so funny. And you pronounced draft exactly the right way, because it sounds draft. Much more romantic when you say draw.
It's so funny.
I'm going to say fast draw.
I did with the Berkeley. That's in Britain. Berkeley is pronounced Berkeley. So it's actually like an English thing. So it's the Americans, as usual, who pronounce it wrong.
It's true. And I have to say, I that I love your podcast. And every once in a while, because I'm half New Zealander, I'm both New Zealander and American, every once in a while, I hear the tinge of a New Zealand accent in you. And I know that comes from your husband and from living there, but just a few words. And it's so sweet when I hear that.
Oh, there we go. Makes you feel at home. Okay. So just before we get into the memoir stuff, just tell us a little bit more about you and how you got into writing and publishing.
Okay. Well, typical story. I'd wanted to be a writer my whole life. Went to school for it, got my Master of Fine Arts in creative writing. And then I proceeded to completely stop writing altogether because I was super frustrated trying to write the great American novel and absolutely failing. And I spent 7 years writing 3 books, which I never reached the end on. They just would go in the drawer at 500 pages long, and they were horrible. They were character studies. I didn't know what I was doing. I hadn't really learned in my master's program how to write a book. And in 2006, I heard about NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, and I thought it was a terrible idea and no real writer would ever do such a thing. And the day after I heard about it, I signed up for it because I had to challenge myself. And I realized in doing NaNoWriMo that my method is a fast, terrible draft. I finished the book that year. I slapped the end at like 50,002 words or something like that. And it wasn't until the next year that I got it out. And I was astonished to find that it was actually the best writing I'd ever done. I had assumed it was terrible while I was writing because it felt terrible, but it was revisable. And I revised it to the best of my ability. I didn't really know what I was doing there either, and sent it off, got an agent. She sold that in a 3-book deal to HarperCollins, and that's kind of where it all began. And I have more books traditionally published, but not by many now. I'm up to about 20 or 23 books, I think 22 books. I was going to count them. But a few years ago, I decided to try indie publishing, and I took a pen name and I started a whole new romance line, and it was such an eye-opener, such a revelation. It ended up doing well enough that one of my Australian publishers wanted me to write for them in that world, but under my own name, Rachel Herron. So I brought all those books over. They're all under my name now. So I do have everything under my name. But I just have found the hybrid model is awesome for me because nobody wants to buy literary fiction indie published yet. It's going to happen. It will happen. But until then, I do literary fiction and or memoir with New York, and most of my romance is indie pub now. So,
well, it's so funny because I think in that answer, which was really interesting, you said 2 things that kind of blow some myths out the water. I didn't learn to write a book doing an MFA, and nobody wants to buy literary fiction. So that's obviously this. But what's interesting, so you teach writing at some of these very respected writing places, and like that's what's so interesting about you. I think you are spanning multiple worlds, as in like you have this attitude about indie, and then as in you're very pro indie, you are indie, you're hybrid, and then you're also, you've got 1 foot in traditional publishing and academia. So how do you how have you sort of welded those two together? And do you struggle to be Rachel when you're with the indies and then Rachel when you're with the kind of MFA writing elite type thing?
What an interesting question. I used to struggle with that because there was such, a stigma about indie publishing, but it's kind of the same way. It feels the same way with romance. Romance also has a stigma, right? So it took me a number of years to be able to hold my head up high and go into a room full of academics and say, yes, I write romance as well as these other things. Yes, it is incredibly feminist and amazing. And yes, I believe in indie publishing. And here's why. And a few years ago, it was hard to say that. And now I have to tell you that the tide has turned so much that even when I say this in academic circles, it used to be that people would recoil. And now, even there, which I think is probably the last bastion of holding out against indie publishing, they lean in and they say, you know what? I've heard that. You can really do that. So it's super exciting. I think it's an exciting time to be there.
That's so interesting. So let's get into memoir, because memoir is one of the many things that you write and do.
Truly my favorite thing to do.
Oh,
and
that's
my favorite thing to teach by far.
Okay, yeah. Well then tell us, first of all, what is your definition of memoir and why is it your favorite?
There's something about crafting your own truth, which is truly true. I know that sounds redundant, but there's something about crafting the truth and shaping your own narrative in a way that is pleasing and useful. And to help people do this, to teach people to do this, and to do it myself, I find the ultimate satisfaction. It almost feels sometimes like writing fiction. I love writing fiction, and I do more of it than I do memoir, obviously. It sells better. But fiction is almost a cheat. You know, I know that I can craft this narrative to suit what I want, the emotions I want to elicit from a reader. Whereas my life, if I told you in order of what happened, it's incredibly boring. And I'll tell you right now, because everybody asks next, what is the difference between autobiography and memoir? Mm-hmm. And the simplest way to look at that is autobiography is the story of your life. You get one. You get one autobiography. Some people try to push it, but they shouldn't. I think it was Quentin Crisp who said something like, I'll butcher this, but he said, your autobiography is a book about your life with the last chapter missing. You know, basically, you write it right before you die. But memoir is a collection of stories or a story about either a specific slice of time in one's life, say the 2 years you spent traveling in the Andes, or it's the story or stories on a specific theme in your own life. My memoir that Chronicle bought is that one. It's a collection of essays about, don't laugh, but I'm a very big knitter as well. But it was a collection of essays about my life as seen through the sweaters that were on my needles at the time. So basically knitting was kind of the background music. But crafting a book, especially when it's these essays on a specific theme, you still want to look at the narrative arc and how to pull the reader in and how to fulfill the storytelling promise to the reader, even though you're telling them a true story.
Mm. Well, again, there's so much that I think on knitting, it's interesting. I actually think knitting is a bit like romance used to be. It used to be that knitting was the kind of, don't mention that I'm a knitter. Now everyone's like, yeah, I'm knitting and I'm, you know, a 22-year-old tattooed, blooming, whatever, goth pop, you know. And it just like, yes. Knitting yes. seems very
that's
cool
true.
Now, you know. So I think knitting, that's why
thank
a publisher
God.
Bought it, because knitting is in vogue. I mean, it really is. Okay, so
exactly.
Back on the memoir, not knitting. but interesting. So you mentioned truly true, which I really like, because as you say, like autobiography has a level of truth, like this happened here and this happened there. Mm-hmm. But memoir to me, like you say, the truth underlying, say, the theme, there are ways where you might not necessarily tell the whole truth, what actually mm-hmm. happened. So what, mm-hmm. you know, so what do you mean by truly true, and how true does a memoir have to be to still be called a memoir?
I think this is the number one question that students have about writing memoir, because the fact is the truth that lives in our memories is actually shifting. They science has proven that every time we take a memory out of our brain and look at it, we're actually changing the memory a little bit. We're rewriting it and re-encoding it as we put it back in the drawer of our brain, which freaks everyone out when they learn that, because there are people with very, very good memories who will swear, no, I am the memory keeper of my family. I know what my uncle said that Christmas. I know it word for word for word. And they may think that, and they may be better than I am. I have a terrible memory, and that's why I write everything down. But the truth in the memory is changed every time you pull it out. That's how memories start to shift. And that's how I hold a memory that's different from my sister's memory, even though we were in the same room at the same time. But the point of memoir, there have been some memoirs that have been blown out of the water. And we all remember Oprah yelling at James Fry about his memoir, where the truth was not adhered to. I believe that is wrong. There are people who will argue all kinds of things, but when I read a memoir, I expect it to be true to the best of the author's ability. I understand as a human being that she may be getting things wrong. She may be conflating incidents. She is recreating dialogue. That's a standard trope in memoir. But I want her to be telling her truest truth. And so when I'm teaching this, there's a couple of things I encourage my students to do. And the first is to think about the room tone, and I call it room tone. It's something that people use in AV. It takes the kind of the ambient noise in the room so that they can strip it away later. It's the feeling, the emotion in the room. I know that when I look at a specific memory, if I look at the room tone and see, you know, what was the emotion in the room that day, that's something I can remember better than exactly what my mom said or exactly what my sister said, right? So if I look at the truth and try to examine that for what was emotionally going on in the room at the time, I can kind of grab a feeling of what happened. And then I have a particular rule that that I call Rachel's 80% rule. If you are 80% sure, if 80% or more sure that someone would have said or done something, then you get to write it as if they did. Like if I was writing, I remember one time when my father put a nail through his thumb while he was hammering. I do not remember exactly what he said, but I am like 97% sure he said, "God bless America," because he always "God bless America" when he hurts himself. So when I write that down, it's not coming from my memory, but I know it's true. Does that make sense?
I guess it also depends on, you have to edit the result of what you're writing. So of course, as you say, who specifically said what, you know, you're just never going to get that. And I remember I did a degree in psychology, and one of the things was witness testimony around stuff, which, as we know, unfortunately, actually ends up being not great in many ways. So that the human brain changes things. But also it's good because that plasticity means people can recover from trauma as well. But I still want to stay on this true thing, because say you have a theme which is around a certain topic, not knitting. I mean something deeper. Say, let's say a recovery from a trauma, like your physical. Yeah. Let's say physical recovery from a trauma of war or something. There might be ways that you can tell your truth about maybe a story or something that happened to somebody else, not you, that would give the point, or that you're telling it from a different perspective. Or do you see what I mean? Like, how close can you get to that line? Or do you think the line is literally, if it didn't happen to you in that way, you can't write that?
I believe it comes down to, and I know this is not an entirely satisfactory answer, but I believe it comes down to a gut check. Mary Carr, who wrote Lit and Cherry and The Art of Memoir, which is a great book, she has a quote that I actually wrote down here. She says, "The untruth is simple making up events with the intention to deceive."
Okay.
So if you go in and write a scene that didn't happen, that you know didn't happen, just to prove a point on your theme, I believe that is wrong and you shouldn't do it. However, I really like what you asked about things that happen to other people and owning that. A lot of people will say, well, you can't write about what happened to me because that's my story. But Andre Debuse III wrote Townies, which was tangentially a story about how his brother was sexually abused by an older woman. And he wrote about that, and he was asked about it, and he said, well, everything that happened to my brother on the other side of the door is his story. But what I could hear in the hallway, that's my story. Mm. So owning your own story and telling the truth as much as you can, I think, and always returning to that gut check. Is this what I know to be true? And actually in Fast Draft Your Memoir, I told a memory about when I had heard about NaNoWriMo, because I've told this story so many times. And then when I was about halfway through writing the book, I decided, because I've been blogging since 2002, and I thought, oh, did I write about learning about NaNoWriMo in 2006? And so I went back, and part of my story was completely untrue. It had happened 2 weeks before. I'd always said it happened. And I didn't know that. My story is better if I tell it that I found out about NaNoWriMo on Halloween the night before it begins. So I had to come up with it on the spot, which is what I have believed for years. Mm. Years. Somehow I got that thing confused, but actually I found out about it on October 12th. So I can never tell that story, the really good story that gets people going again, because I know it's not true. Mm. But I didn't take it out of the book. You know, halfway through the book, I said, oh my God, I just learned that I have fabricated that part of it. So here's the truth. And I'm not ashamed of that, because I believe that was true, and I will go forward knowing the truth now.
Yeah. Okay. But then I'm still on this. Yes. What about, you mentioned your sister, your mum, your dad. What about if you want to protect people that you know and love? Something happened to you and they were part of that. But you know, if you share the real truth, you are going to either hurt them and you don't want to hurt them, or you do want to hurt them, but you might get sued or something like that. So how do we authentically write the truth while still protecting those two angles?
That is the number two most popular question for students. I think that's something that worries us tremendously, and it should. Telling your truth really, really, really could hurt other people. But my answer to that is, when you write your memoir, in order to be able to trust your gut and have that truth come out onto the page, you have to write it as if no one will ever see it. I like to think that I am a 98-year-old woman. Everyone who has ever loved me and everyone who has ever loved those people are all dead. There's been some kind of nuclear catastrophe. It's me in a tower writing my memoir. And I write that way first. And that's the way I think that everyone should write. Mary Carr also said that your book is not going to jump out of your computer and land on bookshelves. It's impossible. So you cannot hurt the people by writing this memoir, but I do believe in password protecting your computer if you live with someone who might snoop. You know, that has definitely happened. But after you've written it and after you've cooled off, There are the sections that you know the sections that will upset your mother. You know them. At that point, when the book is done and it's the best you can do, then you get to think about how you will handle the people in your life. And there are several different ways to do it. And I'm going to tell you my way, if you don't mind, that I handle it. There are a certain group of people in my life, my sisters, my wife. Okay, that's it. That they get absolute veto power over anything I write about them. I choose to give them that. I don't have to give them that. But their relationships to me are so intensely strong. They are the ones that truly matter. And I would not break faith with them at all. And so when I'm done writing something, I send it to them. Just that section. I don't send them the whole book. I don't send it, or whatever, you know, creative nonfiction piece I'm working on. I don't send them the whole thing. I just send them the paragraphs with them in them, or the chapter with them in them. And they get to read them, and they get line editing veto power. They can take out anything. And it's only been used once by one of my sisters, who's the more private one. And it was a very minor thing. It didn't matter. But if she'd said to take out the whole chapter, I would have. The other two don't care. They're always just like, I don't want to read it, but it's fine. Say what you want to say. But when it comes to other family and other friends, I don't give them that. For example, if I write something about my friend Sophie Littlefield, which I did recently, I send it to her when it's done. And I say, are you okay with me using your name? Or do you want me to change your name and distinguishing characteristics? And she gets to say that, because you can disguise your friends a lot more easily than you can disguise your family. That's the hard part. If you're talking about an uncle who molested you, you can't, somebody's going to say, oh my God, you're talking about Fred, you know? That's the danger in this. So friends, you can easily disguise, change the names. You can also change names and distinguishing characteristics, which is acceptable to do in memoir. You can always change, though you can actually straight up lie about what they look like, where they lived, what their names are in order to protect them. It is harder to do with family members. There is an Anne Lamott, really famous quote, and that she said, "You own everything that happened to you. Tell your stories. If people wanted you to write warmly about them, they should have behaved better," which is a great quote. And it's said everywhere, but a lot of memoirists take that to mean that I get to talk about whoever I want, the way I want to do it, and hurt them if I want to, and they should have acted better. But they don't know that Anne Lamott also went on to say, "I'm not going to publish anything that anyone I'm close to would be hurt by or would hate. And I know how much I'll end up taking out. Telling the truth in memoir isn't telling all the truths. It's not spewing. Anything I'm writing will be completely crafted and edited before it's published." So we can write this first draft in the white hot heat of anger, fury, rage, pain, trauma. And then after it's done and we've cooled off and looked at it and decided how much Uncle Fred is going to need to see of this, or is, you know, is everything going to explode? We get to edit it at that point to our particulars. But the truth is, a very real memoir could explode that part of a life. And writers do have to ask that about them, of themselves. Am I willing to do this?
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, Anne Lamott, and I've read quite a lot of her books. She writes about her faith, which I find very interesting. But she wrote a book about her son when he was not old enough to give permission.
So operating instructions.
Yeah. So, yeah, about being a new mom, right? And how tough it was for her and things. So this is the interesting thing. So and we need to, it's really good to look at the people who are writing these things. So did you see the Joan Didion thing on Netflix?
Yes, it was actually a Kickstarter for it.
Yes, it was brilliant. Yeah. And what was interesting, because you mentioned your wife, she said she and her husband, who was also a writer, shared what they wrote. And even if they were writing nasty things about each other, they still respected each other as writers and actually just went ahead with that. So I find that really interesting. So then I have so many questions I want to talk about. I'm trying to pick the right one.
May I say one thing while I'm thinking about it to that point? A really good trick to remember in memoir, and it's not hard to pull off, is to always make yourself look the worst on the page. Unless you're actually trying to send Uncle Fred to jail, you know, we are all fallible. We're all broken. We all have flaws. And when you highlight and illustrate your own flaws, when you write a book trying to do that, to share your shame and to find empathy, and you put the spotlight on yourself and your flaws, it does help when other people are being looked at. Does that make sense?
We're being
the most true about ourselves and kind to others, I believe, works really well.
Yeah, kind. And what I was going to say was Elizabeth Gilbert. So if you write a memoir that becomes as big as Eat, Pray, Love, then, I mean, people think that's your life. So this is what's so interesting. I don't know if you've seen her relationship with that man ended. Yeah. And she left him for a woman who has subsequently died. And
just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it's just this tragic story. But what I think is so interesting about memoir is most people in the world see her trapped in Eat, Pray, Love. Eat, Pray, Love is who Elizabeth Gilbert is to those people. So as a writer who writes memoir and your life moves on the moment you've submitted that manuscript, are you the same person? And how does it feel to look back on a memoir thinking with the understanding that that's how people see you?
I think that is why memoir is so addictive. The difference between autobiography and memoir is that you can have as many memoirs as you want. And Big Magic, which was Elizabeth Gilbert's
nonfiction.
Second nonfiction, that was a little bit memoirish. And I've wondered a few times if that was her reclaiming space again for herself in a different place from Eat, Pray, Love. And this is going to sound terrible, but I can't wait for her next memoir.
I completely understand. Yeah.
And this lot, I mean, one of my favorite types of memoir is the love memoir and the grief memoir. Joan Didion's Year of Magical Thinking is one of the best books ever.
Yeah.
So, I can imagine that she is very uncomfortable still being placed inside that box. And I am not the same person I was when I wrote my first memoir. My second memoir is actually being shopped right now. So I am much more closer. I'm much closer to that person now. But yeah, that is difficult. We do change.
Yeah, because I remember reading Wild by Cheryl Strayed and loving it. And then I was actually quite disappointed to realize that she'd written that about something like 13 years ago, the experience.
Yeah.
And it almost made me feel like it wasn't true because it was written so far in the past. So how do you feel about that in terms of the distance and whether like you said, I think it felt like she just written it about last summer. Maybe you have to say this was this much time ago. What do you think about that sort of reflection on a time period?
It's interesting that you say that because I remember having the exact same feeling. I gave her license in my mind to do that. And I was comfortable with her doing that because she kept a journal on the way and she kept a deliberate, very detailed journal along the way because she was alone. She had nothing else to do but read the one book she had with her at the time and write in the journal. And many people need a distance of time from the point, especially if they're writing about a slice of time as she was, they need a distance from that to process it. There's a really interesting phenomenon in memoir that happens where we are two people as we're writing. We're basically three. We're the author, of course. We're writing about a character and we have to treat ourselves as a character with a character arc, with motion and change in our lives. So we're writing about this character as we are at the same time the narrator. So the narrator has way more information than the character did in that point. And you can write memoir from kind of two places and you can intermix them. You can write this character as she was 15 years ago, only knowing what she knew, which is a fine way to write a memoir, or you can choose to sprinkle in the knowledge of the narrator as you go lightly, you know? So perhaps your reader will know that that shotgun is the one that shot Uncle Dave. I'm always beating up uncles. My uncle is fine, but you know, perhaps we'll tell that that is going to happen even though our character at that point doesn't know what's going to happen. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that happens in fiction, like, you know, all the time. That was the last day he would ever go and do that. Stephen King just did that in Sleeping Beauties, which I just finished reading. And I actually don't know if I like that. I was like, I didn't want to know that. You've already told me that this person is going to die or whatever. So it's interesting, isn't it? Our different reactions as readers. So, I mean, obviously you read a lot of memoir and
all of it.
Yeah. Or good and bad. So what are the worst mistakes or the most common mistakes that writers are making with memoir?
There are two large mistakes and they're very, very integrally related. First, they are not detailed enough in the exterior senses. Second, they are not detailed enough in the interior visceral happenings within the body, which is exactly the same thing in fiction. But the truth of writing is the more specific we are, the more universal our experience becomes. And I've had so many students come to me and say, well, I don't want to, if I describe the lemon yellow clock with the nightingale that popped out on the hour, that will alienate the person who's never had a cuckoo clock on the wall. And it's absolutely the wrong response. The more detailed we are, the more the reader is drawn in and the more we believe it. So we want those exterior sense details, the sight, sound, smell, touch, taste. But even more importantly, we want to show our reader what's happening viscerally in our bodies. Again, this goes back to Rachel's 80% rule. Combined with the excellent tool, which is the Emotion Thesaurus. Do you know
yes.
that one?
Yes, Becca's oh. on the show. So yeah,
oh, I haven't heard that one. I'll have to go look that one up.
It's in the queue.
Oh, fantastic. So for people who might not know, who haven't listened to that episode yet, basically she writes these amazing books. The one I love the most is the Emotion Thesaurus because it's basic and it's the first place to start, but she has more. And you look up the emotion, anger, rage, hate, lust. And first you see the exterior clues that you could see on someone having that reaction. So if I remember that my father was incredibly angry at me, I can look at the anger list and pull out some things that I think on an 80% or better chance, he probably was bawling his fists and the
frowning on
his temple. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Frowning. But then even better is the next part of anger is what we feel internally. The reason we tell the reader what we're feeling internally is because if I say I felt ashamed, there's meaning there, but it's very lightweight and it's easy to skim. But if I actually say what happens in my body that I cannot prevent happening, people cannot prevent visceral responses from happening. Even if they can't access where that emotion lives in their body, they still have the reaction. They still get the headache. They still get the sweat, the tight
flush. Stomach. You get that flush, don't you? Yeah.
Yes. And because they've proven that words on the page, when we read words on the page, they've only recently proven this in the last 10 years or so. When we read a scent related word like lavender, or our olfactory cortex lights up. If we read that someone's about to ride a bike, our motor cortex literally becomes ready to ride a bike. If you were to, it starts to prep. So when I tell you the visceral reaction I'm having in my body, you automatically on a lizard brain level understand how I feel much better if I just said I felt ashamed, which are just flat words. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And that is the definition of show, don't tell. You don't say I am ashamed. You describe the flush, you know, or that type of thing. And that's what's so important.
And it's interesting, in memoir, people forget that. They don't think that they need to bring the same tools of that we use in fiction in. The other thing about memoirists, and you might have some listeners on your show like this, memoirists often are not, they want to write memoir more than anything else. So they're not natural writers. They haven't been studying fiction for years. They don't know these techniques. They come in a little bit blind. They just want to write their book. They're kind of baby writers. So teaching them these tricks automatically ramps up their believability and the strength in their writing immediately. And we could all use that. I need to add those things to all my writing always.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's interesting. Right now I'm doing a screenplay adaptation. And of course, you can't do interior.
Oh, my God.
So I'm trying to look at my chapter. And one of my chapters, I was like, okay, this is going from a whole chapter to like two lines on the page because it's all interior. And really all she did was like walk into a room. And all I can say in a screenplay is, you know, Rachel walked into the living room. I can describe the cuckoo clock, but I can't say what's going on inside your body.
That sounds awful. That sounds like hell.
It's a really interesting challenge. But actually, I think one of the things that is in screenwriting that I think also is in memoir is symbolism. So I was reading someone's memoir and he had written this thing all about how much his children made him feel caged. And he'd said that out loud, whereas all he could have shown him behind a closed door or some kind of symbol of being trapped that was not just, you know, telling it out loud. So that's metaphor and symbolism is important in memoir, right?
Absolutely. And to be able to look at our lives and pick touchstones and carry them through into the memoir is actually much easier than we think. If I tell any student to pick the touchstone that they had with them at the time, they will find something. They will be able to find a physical metaphor in their lives that they can use in the book. It's super, super interesting and it's very effective.
Mm. No, that's cool. Really cool. Now, I want to just move on because we're almost out of time, actually. But what's interesting about your title, so fast draft your memoir, write your life story in 45 hours, which is a new thing, I think. And I wonder if you've had, a bit of a backlash from some people who think that a memoir should take several years to write. But why 45 days? And what are your productivity tips for getting it done like that?
Well, not 45 days, as you just said.
Oh, 45 hours. Sorry. Yeah.
Yes. No, but that's, and that's where the backlash is coming from. People read 45 hours and think 45 days. And it isn't that. As I say in the book, I believe that even new writers with some dedicated practice at writing fast and badly and getting out of the way of the inner editor can write about 1,000 words an hour, if not a little bit more. So, and in the book, I walk you through how to come up with your memoir, how to drill down and pick a section of your life that you want to talk about. But I don't let you have very much time for that. Maybe 4 hours max, 4 or 5 hours. So a nice sized memoir for self-publishing would be anything from 40,000 up. And, you know, if you're going to go traditional, you're probably going to go more around 60 or more, not to exceed 100,000 words. But so you can actually get those done in that 45 hours. But the only way you're going to do that is to go quickly and not go back and revise as you go. I really believe that writing an entire full manuscript badly is the best way to write a book, mm-hmm. unless you are editing as you go, you're revising as you go, and you're finishing books. The and has to be there. I know so many writers who revise as they go and they don't finish books. So if that happens to be you, try the dashing to the end pell mell. The tools that I always recommend are, you know, kind of the tools that maybe everyone has talked about, but schedule it, put it on your calendar. Even if it's just 30 minutes in the morning, that 45 hours is going to stretch out. You know, there have been a couple people who think that how many times does 8 go into 45? I have no idea.
Like
six-ish. Yeah.
Five, six.
Yeah. Some people think, oh, well, that's 6 business days. I can write my memoir in 6 business days. And I make very clear in there, no, this is 45 hours of writing time. This is thinking time. This is deep work time. Mm-hmm. It is not possible to sit down and write for 8 hours your memoir and be done in 6 days. It's absolutely not possible physically. But if you can only get 30 minutes a day, great. Schedule it on your calendar. Get it done. I like to get out of the house. Because in my house, I get really distracted. There's always dogs to pet and dishes to do. I believe in taking yourself away from distraction. I use the program called Freedom to boot me off the internet for 45 minute sessions. So if you're at the cafe, you're not talking to anybody, you have no internet, eventually you will get bored enough that you have to write. So that's, and then I go back online for 15 minutes and nothing has changed, even though I think the world must have changed in those 45 minutes I was offline. And then I go and then I do it again. I also really believe in Write or Die, the program.
Oh yeah. I use that in my first NaNoWriMo.
Yes. I still use it when I'm stuck in books, when I can't get word count done. Basically Write or Die, you turn it on and it gives you certain punishments or rewards for writing. I use it on the very mild setting where when I'm writing and if I slow down or stop, the screen turns red, which reminds me just to keep my fingers moving. Just keep writing crap. You'll fix it later. There is the kamikaze mode, which if you stop writing, it will eat your words backwards. There's no way to get them back. And as my friend Adrienne Bell says, she goes, it's not called write or annoy, Rachel. It's called write or die for a reason.
And then they have this screechy violin noise. It's very good. And it's at writeordie.com, I think. And it's like, I think you can either use it free or you can get like $10 or something. So it's a good investment.
It's pretty inexpensive. I have actually dedicated a couple books to it in my acknowledgements because they wouldn't have been done otherwise. But yeah, so pushing yourself, but the most important thing is pushing yourself to a terrible draft so that you can revise it later. That's probably the best process for most people. And I will die on this hill. I'm convinced of this.
Oh no, I'm with you. I'm definitely, I have to finish a draft before I edit. Just, you know, before we almost close up, I think, people who listen to the show will know, I've interviewed quite a lot of people on memoir, and it's funny because I tiptoe towards it and then I back away.
I know you do.
But, you know, and it's funny, and I'm trying to understand why. I mean, The Healthy Writer, which I've just put out, has some real, you know, sort of personal stuff in. And I'm the Successful Author Mindset. I feel like I'm stepping towards writing memoir in some way, but maybe I'm just scared of it. So let's address that. If people want to write a memoir, but they feel scared in some way. Where do you think that fear, what is that fear about? And, you know, why is it worth writing?
I can tell you exactly what I think it's about. As human beings, especially in this society, there is a pressure to look perfect, right? There's, you know, in Instagram, Pinterest, all of those places. When we write authentically about our true selves, it is embarrassing because I am extremely flawed. But I have heard you say this on your show. When you go deepest into yourself and share the things that scare you the most, those are the reactions that are huge to your show. When you have those shows where you lay your heart bare on the page. I believe, didn't you put in, it wasn't your journal, but it was something about the process in one of your books. You actually put in journal entries into a book.
In the mindset book.
The mindset book. That's what it is. And when we show ourselves authentically, we are risking shame, which is, I believe, the strongest human emotion. Brené Brown is always talking about shame. But when we present our authentic selves and show our shame, it is met 98% of the time with understanding, compassion, and empathy. And shame cannot survive empathy. When you, Joanna, write something personal that is difficult for you about writing, you do not hear from your readers like, oh my, I can't believe you're supposed to be an expert. How dare you? What you hear is, thank God you said what I feel in my heart. I really needed to hear that. You get that empathy from all sides and it makes you braver. So I believe, number one, you have got to write this memoir. I want to read it. Number two, I think you're doing it exactly right. You're kind of doing it almost on a practice level. You sprinkle it into books. You show your true heart in your books. You get a good reaction. You share it on your show. You get a good reaction. You're developing the tools of bravery. It is harder for people who don't have that kind of resource, but I really recommend for any aspiring memoirists to join a class or a meetup somewhere locally with other memoirists, because there's this incredible experience that happens in an actual sit-down class where you'll be reading this person's work, you know, maybe just a chapter from the book, and you'll see their hand shaking because they're telling you something incredibly, desperately embarrassing or shameful or horrific. And they're expecting to be yelled at. And instead the class embraces them and lifts them up and says, I've been there too. And that's horrible. I'm sorry you had to go through that. So if you can, share your work with other writers. But I will be really clear here. When you're writing memoir, do not share it with anybody that you know. Hmm. I talk a lot about that in the book. There's very good reasons for this. These are very important stories. We don't want to break them before they even get out of your body and onto the page.
Yeah. And often those are the people who we want to read them. And unfortunately, the people we love the most are not our audience for any of our books. I mean, I'm constantly upset that, you know, people, you know, don't read my stuff. And then I'm like, no, they are not your audience. That's not who we're here for. So, No, I hear you.
My wife stopped reading one of my books in the middle. I'm still mad at her. And in fact, she won't ever finish because I keep bringing it up.
That's brilliant. Okay, so we're pretty much out of time, but I want people to know that you have podcasts, plural. So just tell people about your podcast and where people can find them if they want to hear from you some more.
Yeah, I have one called How Do You Write, which you have been on now twice. So and then the most recent one talking about the healthy writer. And so that's How Do You Write. I interview other writers about their process because I'm a process junkie. I'm always looking for the magic bullet, which doesn't exist, but I want somebody to make writing easy for me someday. So that's why I have this podcast. Once a year, I go through and talk about my, what I made that year, where the money came from, how I work. That New Year's episode went up last month. So that's a fun podcast. And I also do a joint podcast with Jay Thorne, your co-writer, which is called The Pedal to the Metal. Petal, like a flower, to the metal. And on that, we just talk about being working writers. We started it as we both made the jump to full-time writing. I jumped about 2 years ago and he just jumped last year. And now we just talk about all sorts of, all aspects of the writing life. So that's fun. I'm also available all over the internet. Rachel Herron. I'm not Rachel Herron. I did not write 2K to 10K, which is a great book. We're constantly getting mixed up.
Oh, that's
my
name
doppelganger.
Well,
she's funny.
She's been on the show too, and I had never ever thought of you as the same person. So don't you worry.
That's good. So rachelherron.com on Twitter. I do have on patreon.com/Rachel, R-A-C-H-A-E-L. I'm doing a memoir project right now on replenishing because I burned out last year. And so I'm spending 12 months replenishing my creative life in all different aspects, music and gardening and physicality and spirituality. So for as little as a buck a month, you can get those essays as I'm writing them.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for
May I mention one more thing? I do a free email to writers once a week, just writing encouragement. And that's at my website. Just you can sign up there. It's really fun. It's just for writers.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Rachel. That was great.
Thanks, Jo.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Rachel Herron today. It certainly gives me a lot to think about around my ideas for memoir. And of course, I am still on the side writing the shadow book or getting ideas for the shadow book. I have put words on the page, but that might be a long work in progress. Coming up next week, I'll be talking about building a youpreneur business around a personal brand with Chris Ducker. So very much a switch to the business and nonfiction side after a craft interview today. So have a wonderful writing week and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.